This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work offers a one-year advanced standing option for students with a bachelor's degree in social work that builds on prior training and connects students with expert faculty and five specialized pathways. Apply by February 1st at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future. WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
America's central bank cut its interest rate again for the second time this year. So getting down to brass tacks, what does that mean for you and your money? I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. The Federal Reserve trimmed its key interest rate by a quarter percentage point last week, a decision that can affect everything from credit card rates to car buyers to corporations to people with money in high-yield savings accounts. To discuss what that cut could mean for you and to talk about her new book, How to Retire, we had Christine Benz on, Director of Personal Finance and Retirement Planning at Morningstar. A lot of big news in the last week. We've got a new president-elect. We also got another rate decrease from the Fed. So I asked Christine, when the Federal Reserve cuts rates, where do average people see the impact? Here's her response.
Well, they see it if they are borrowers of any kind and they have any sort of loan that is adjustable in terms of its interest rate. So credit cards are a big category there. Some people, though a shrinking share, still have adjustable rate mortgages that actually move in sync with the direction of interest rates. Most people, my hope is, took pains to lock in a fixed rate when rates were so low for so long.
Yeah. So if the Fed continues to lower rates over time, the high yield savings accounts where people have been earning 4 or 5% on their money, those will also see their rates go down. So what's your advice for people who have been using high yield savings to generate interest income for themselves?
Well, shop around because there is a differential between various types of accounts. And also keep in mind, you know, how liquid you need those funds to be. So if you need ready access to your cash to pay a tuition bill or your tax bill or whatever, you don't want to be using CDs, certificates of deposit. Mm-hmm. But because they do require you to tie your money up for a little longer, CDs do tend to offer higher yields than you can find on those liquid accounts. So bear in mind your own need for liquidity. And the other thing with cash, Sasha Ann, is just don't overdo those cash instruments. Yields have been really, really attractive. They are going down. And if we see inflation, that takes a big bite out of the interest that you're able to earn on those safe savings accounts. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So for people with credit card debt, is it time to perhaps call your credit card company and try to negotiate your rate?
For sure. Never, not a bad time to do that. But especially as we are seeing rates really soaring on credit cards, it is a good time to call your existing credit card company or perhaps shop around. You may be able to transfer that balance to another card that may have a lower sort of teaser rate. And then you can just, you know, make an aggressive plan to try to attack that debt while you're keeping the interest down.
Some folks may not even have been aware that you can negotiate your rate. Can you walk us through what that could sound like?
Yeah. So call the number on the back of your card and ask to speak to someone about potentially lowering your interest rate. People may be surprised to hear that there is some leeway there oftentimes because, you know, what you see is interest rates today that are over 20% and the bank is making a lot on those accounts. So they may be able to cut some of that fat in order to keep you in that.
Yeah. For that other big news story of the last week, Christine, former President Trump is now President-elect Trump. Going into the election, I remember polls were showing that the race was neck and neck, but he did end up winning all seven battleground states and the popular vote. So this was not a long drawn out contest, and the stock market actually quickly surged due to that certainty in that situation. So I feel like that might have gotten a lot of people thinking, you know, do I need to change my investment strategy because the market's going to go up?
Well, probably not. You don't want to be thinking on a really short-term basis in terms of your investment portfolio. What the market seems to be responding to, at least in the very short term, is that a President Trump has said that he would be kind of anti-regulation. He would probably try to keep tax rates nice and low, may even address some other tax cuts in addition to maintaining the status quo with tax rates. So that's what the stock market is responding to. It's interesting, Sasha, and in the bond market, the market participants seem a little bit concerned about inflation there.
Okay.
That there are some measures of inflation that the bond market is flashing. The tariffs in particular that Donald Trump talked about leading up to his election, there's widespread concern that those might in fact be inflationary. And so the bond market has been a little bit nervous about that.
Bonds sank, right?
They did. They've come back a little bit, but it appears that there's some worry about inflation. So I always say, with respect to your portfolio, you should focus on your own situation first and foremost, and specifically your proximity to needing your money. Mm-hmm. Use that to guide the decisions that you make.
So seeing something like that, right? Seeing stocks soar to record highs after Trump won, and then bonds sinking, as we just talked about. I mean, what does this mean for your average individual investor?
Well, I would keep time horizon in mind. So people who are, say, under 50 should maintain equity-heavy portfolios, portfolios with a lot of stock exposure. But people who are getting close to retirement, I would say if you're within 5 to 10 years of retirement, even though stocks have been soaring, you do want to de-risk that portfolio because we don't know what will happen. Mm-hmm. And so the last thing you want to be doing is you don't want to be a seller of stocks if they encounter some turbulence. And so you want to set your portfolio up with enough liquid, safer assets, and that would mean cash and perhaps bond funds in addition to that stock portfolio.
Yeah. The full title of your wonderful book, which I have in my hands here, How to Retire, 20 Lessons for a Happy, Successful, and Wealthy Retirement. I love that you put the word happy in there.
First.
So often we think of retirement, we just think about the dollars and cents, right? So talk about this project.
Yeah, so the project is actually a series of interviews. Each chapter is a lesson about how to do some aspect of retirement planning. And a lot of it is financial, but it's not meant for financial professionals. It's meant for novices. And it talks about how much you can safely withdraw from your investment accounts in retirement, how to structure your investment portfolio for retirement. Mm-hmm. But it also talks about the non-financial side of the ledger. And that's one thing I've realized, even though I spent a lot of my career talking about investments, I think I had underrated the importance of purpose and identity and relationships later in life. Mm-hmm. And that's something a lot of us walk away from when we leave our jobs. So the thing is to be thoughtful about how you are going to replace those things when you're no longer working.
So it's like thinking about your money, but your quality of life as well.
Absolutely. And having a vision for how you'll spend your days. I have come to be a big fan of kind of phasing into retirement if you have the leeway to do so and have the appetite to continue working in some capacity. Can you take the things that you like about your job and carry them forward and do that longer? Mm-hmm. We see a lot of research that points to the fact that people who are able to keep working in some capacity oftentimes are happier than people who fully step away from their work.
So, yeah, you have that in lesson one. It's visualize your in-retirement lifestyle. So, I mean, I immediately start thinking of the beach and sunglasses and my husband and friends and all that. But why is that a great first step?
Well, because you definitely need those things that you are going to do for relaxation and leisure. And that's what many of us come into retirement with, kind of pent up demand to do more of those things, right? The stuff you just talked about. But it's really important to also have some things that you will do to relax from, some things that confer a sense of purpose. And maybe it is, you know, volunteer activities or just finding time to be a great parent or grandparent in a way that you couldn't fully do while you were working. Mm-hmm. So it's up to each of us to kind of envision what we will do to supply purpose. And if we have that purpose, then I think that relaxation will feel all the better. The problem is we have a lot of people in this country who come into retirement just so very burnt out. They haven't been able to really visualize retirement beyond just kind of like parking it on the couch,
right,
and watching Netflix. And the point is, and maybe, you know, maybe you retire and do that for a year or so, but the point is to try to build in some sense of purpose.
Let's check in with someone who's been waiting, Christine. Here's Deanna from River East. Hi, Deanna. Welcome to the show.
Hi there, Sasha. Hi, Christine. My question is, I have pretty good credit history. I've worked very hard to maintain good credit history. You have a good high number in the 700s, but I'm constantly getting offers from personal loans to help reduce my credit card debt. And it's very tempting, but I just didn't know if those are really predatory and if they're a bit scammish because you still end up paying interest rates on those loans. Or should I consider taking out a loan or getting equity to reduce my high credit card rate, even though while my rate is good and my score is good?
Yeah, great question, Deanna.
Yeah, it is correct to have some sense of apprehension with these firms that will purport to help you reduce your debt. For me, I think that the first line of defense here, if you do have credit card debt, would be to talk to your existing lender first and see if you can make some headway there. And then I do think you want to be very careful before engaging with one of these sort of debt consolidation providers. There oftentimes is a profit motive built in. So I would proceed with cautions. There are some good actors and some bad actors. So it's kind of hard to generalize, but first step would be to call that existing lender.
That's a great question, Deanna. Thank you for calling. Now, speaking of credit card interest rates, I mean, if you pay off your credit card in full every month, Christine, is renegotiating that interest rate that we talked about earlier, is that even worth it? Because you wouldn't be generating interest.
Probably not. If you're someone who is perennially paying off debt monthly, which is a great way to do it if you possibly can, you don't need to worry about the interest rate on that credit card. You can switch at some later date if it turns out that you need to carry a balance, but I wouldn't have that as an overriding concern right now.
Yeah. In your book, you write that you need to understand how your spending might change in retirement. Tell us more about what people should keep in mind for that one.
It's really interesting, Sasha Ann, when we look at the data on how people spend in retirement, what we see is it's sometimes been shorthanded as a go-go, slow-go, no-go spending pattern. So the early years of retirement, so say age 65 to 75 for a lot of people, those are the high spending years of retirement. You've got pent-up demand for leisure activities and travel, maybe helping adult children get launched or, you know, pay for weddings and things like that. Those are the high spending years. What we see after that tends to be a steady decline in spending throughout the retirement life cycle. So the 75 to 85 year period is definitely lower spending still.
Yeah.
And then later in life, oftentimes we see spending flare up a little bit for some households, and that's uninsured long-term care costs. Mm-hmm. So it's sometimes been called a retirement spending smile, where you have high spending early, leveling out, and then trailing up later in life for uninsured long-term care costs. So
Factor
that in. I think it's wise to not assume that your spending will go in a straight line throughout retirement. It very likely will follow a pattern, something like that. And we see this with wealthier households mm-hmm. as well as less wealthy households. So it's not like people are spending less because they're worried about running out. We see this even with households with ample amounts of cash.
I see. Interesting. Got a question here for you from WBEZ's Lisa Lavez. She says, what is the best way to make sure you have access to a person's liquid funds or bank accounts when a loved one dies to cover outstanding medical, home, and funeral expenses?
Yeah, really great question, Lisa. So you can, if you have an elderly loved one in your life and you are kind of their trusted family member who's helping them with their financial affairs, they can have what's called a transfer on death assignation with that bank account. So you can talk to your banker about setting the account up in that way so that if you are the person who is charged with paying their bills, the transfer could happen fairly seamlessly. Mm-hmm. So ask the bank about setting up the bank account in that way.
You are likely talking to people from multiple generations right now. I mean, so how should people of different ages approach saving for retirement?
Well, young people should just automate it if they possibly can. We all should be, really. If to the extent that we're still saving for retirement, just put it on autopilot. Mm-hmm. That way you're reducing that friction, you're reducing the temptation, you're not even seeing the funds necessarily hit your checking account. And this is what happens if we participate in employer-provided retirement accounts. Our money is being extracted from our paycheck
right
before we even see it.
And young people should still be thinking, like you said earlier, of phasing into the process, right?
Absolutely. So do whatever you can afford right when you're starting out. And you may have more leeway to save a little bit more when you're starting out because you may be living with your parents or you may have roommates. That may actually be a pretty good time to get started with retirement savings. But automate those deposits into company retirement plan or an IRA and use a stock-heavy portfolio. So you don't really want to have too much in the way of safe investments
right
besides kind of that emergency fund that you would keep separate from your retirement accounts. And then as you age, you would gradually transition into a safer investment portfolio, not entirely safe. And in fact, I would say even people who are embarking on retirement should probably have something closer to a, you know, 50-50 type portfolio, 50% stock, 50% bond and safer assets. But you want to shift into those safer assets, and the intuition there, the logic behind that is that you are taking risk out of your portfolio because you're going to start spending from
right
it at some point. And you don't want to be in that position of having to spend from assets after they've dropped, which is what we see with stocks sometimes.
Yeah. Are there common mistakes or pitfalls that you see people do, like, you know, when it comes to saving for retirement? What can we avoid?
Well, a couple. One would be using a lot of individual holdings, like individual stocks. I know they're very popular, especially among young investors where they are just getting started. But I like the idea of using, you know, just good all-in-one, what are called index tracking funds that just basically mm-hmm. buy the whole U.S. market or buy the whole U.S. and non-U.S. market and call it a day and don't try to pick winners and losers. And the good news is that you will participate in the really great performers in our market. And then you'll also hold maybe next year's great performer if you have that index tracking investment. So getting too finely tuned with your investment portfolio, I think, is a pitfall.
Employer-based 401k and 403b plans can be confusing sometimes. I'm speaking for myself
yes
here. What would you recommend, and how much financial know-how do you think people need to manage their own 401k?
Well, the nice thing with 401ks and 403bs today is that most of them have embraced what are called target date mm-hmm. funds, which is where you kind of look into the future and think about, well, what is my anticipated retirement date, give or take? And so maybe it's 2040 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You can find a fund that is called Target 2040 or some variation thereof. You'll see the year right in the name. And that's all you have to do is pick that fund.
And just put some money into it.
Yeah, just keep it going. They are not universally excellent target date funds, but they really do take the guesswork out of investing for retirement. I remember when I started my career, it wasn't unusual when I would look at people's 401k allocations and they had just put 10% in each of the holdings in the plan because they didn't know where to start.
Mm.
Now, target date funds give you a place to start if you're not sure.
What does a diversified 401k look like for people of different ages?
Well, I think it may be as simple as that, as using that single target date fund.
Yeah.
I would say for young people, they if they're managing it on their own, they would probably want to think about like having 90% stock exposure. And there I would use a fully globally diversified stock portfolio and then maybe a little bit in a safer assets. And then as you move through and get closer to retirement, you would get a little closer to maybe 60-40 or 50-50. Mm-hmm. But this is very individual specific. So like think of that rare bird who is a tenured college professor and has a pension in addition to his or her retirement assets.
Yeah.
Well, in that case, the investment portfolio could be really pretty aggressively positioned because most of that person's income needs for retirement are coming from that pension. You're saving mainly for your heirs or for charity, and you'd probably want to have a more aggressively positioned portfolio. But if you're someone like me who will be coming into retirement with Social Security mm-hmm. and my investment portfolio, and that's it, well, I'd want to be to have more safe assets in that portfolio.
I see. Thanks for clarifying that. We got a voicemail from Susan in Budlong Woods who said, you said earlier, Christine, that spending seems to go up for non-insured or non-planned for medical. She wants to know what you recommend for that, an annuity, a healthcare plan, something else?
This is the elephant in the room for retirement planning, where it's completely outside of our healthcare system as it's currently constructed. So Medicare does not cover these long-term care expenses. These are expenses associated often with cognitive decline or simply with aging, where people cannot do what are called activities of daily living, where it gets difficult to shower or to make meals. All of those things that constitute activities of daily living can prompt us to need long-term care. A lot of people automatically think, well, that's a nursing home. But most people today do receive long-term care in their homes, mm-hmm. Oftentimes through kind of the friends and family network. And adult children are the biggest providers of long-term care.
Right.
In this country, adult daughters, the biggest provider of all. And unfortunately, there can be negative side effects for the children who are providing this care, the family members, where there can be implications for their abilities to continue to do their jobs. Mm-hmm. They have health issues as well. So you have three main ways to address long-term care expenses if you don't want to rely on the friends and family network.
Yeah.
The first would be government provided care. So I mentioned that Medicare doesn't cover long-term care. Medicaid does for people who have exhausted their financial resources. So it is the largest payer of long-term care in this country, and there's definitely no shame in needing Medicaid provided care. The problem is that you'll have less control over where you receive that care. And
yeah.
You may not be able to get it in your home. So that's one category. The other category would be for people who have ample resources. They could potentially self-fund long-term care. What I would do in that case is that I would segregate those funds from my spendable assets, the amount that I plan to spend on my regular living expenses. I would segregate them. And I'd use long-term care costs as a guide about how much to save. So the typical long-term care need is a couple of years, and long-term care expenses now are running like $120,000 a year. So multiply that by 1 to 2 years, and you've got, you know, a lot of money that you're having to
right.
set aside. And then in the middle would be insurance products. The problem is that marketplace has been kind of troubled for reasons I won't get into here, but people have had to confront some really high premium increases. Mm-hmm. People who thought they were doing all the right things and purchasing insurance have had to decide, well, do I lower my benefit or just suck up this premium increase? So it's a little bit of a conundrum in the insurance market.
Yeah. Let's take one last call from Bren in South Shore. Hey, Bren, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so very much. And I think that this is wonderful that you have taken the time to help us old geezers understand what we need to do, when we need to do it, and even some instruction on how. getting to the idea of the long-term care insurance, and there is an issue of having premiums that go up. There are some, or I've been told that there are some plans where you can contribute X number of dollars for X number of years, and you have a established promised benefit that may meet that 2 years. There are those products that are out there. It won't take you beyond that, but fortunately, because during that time, you know, there's a five-year look back for your assets, and that's one of the things that I found that many people are put into a situation where their assets are absorbed by this care. What would you suggest, and when would you suggest, in that retirement planning that you have, that a person protect their assets?
Yeah, let's get you a response here, Bren. Go ahead, Christine.
Sure. So I'll just put a little finer point on this whole look back period that Brent referenced. The basic idea is that some people might be inclined to, because Medicaid does have these strict rules about how much you can have in assets, some people might be inclined to try to preemptively give to family members to try to reduce their assets to qualify for Medicaid provided long-term care.
Yeah.
The problem is that Medicaid does have this what's called a look back period, where if you've given assets away within the past 5 years, that will effectively still be counted as part of your asset pool. So people do need to be aware of the specific rules surrounding Medicaid provided care. In terms of insurance, the products do vary pretty dramatically. My bias here is to get some unbiased guidance on selecting. If you're looking at long-term care insurance,
yeah,
get a helper. Get someone who isn't selling long-term care insurance to help you comparison shop among these products. One flavor of long-term care insurance that has been getting more interest is what's called a hybrid policy, and this is usually a life insurance policy with a long-term care rider.
Yeah.
And that offers kind of a nice optionality, because you know one of those two things will happen, right? You'll either need long-term care, you'll die, and your heirs will get the benefit, the death benefit. So it has a nice optionality to it. The issue is that those products can be complicated, and so you need to do your homework, and then you typically are purchasing them with a lump sum versus a stream of premiums, and so you need to have that lump sum available to you, and you do need to understand the type of product that, that you're buying.
Well, Christine, before we wrap, I got to ask quickly, when are you retiring? Because you're so organized. I mean, do you already have a pin on your calendar?
I don't. I will say, Sashan, I love what I do. So I'm in a luxury position.
Great. We don't want you to go anywhere.
Well, thank you. But I have come to be a big believer in phasing into retirement and using, I would urge people to use what's called the Sunday night calendar test. So you're looking at your calendar on Sunday night, and inevitably you'll see things on it where you're like, oh, I have to get through that. That's not my favorite thing. And then you'll have those things where you're like, oh, that's, I love meeting with that person or whatever it is. Try to bring those things that you love forward, keep doing them longer, and shed those things
that
you don't love as much.
Love that. We've been talking with Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance and Retirement Planning at Morningstar, and author of the new book, How to Retire, 20 Lessons for a Happy, Successful, and Wealthy Retirement. Always a pleasure, Christine.
Sasha Ann, thank you so much.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced and edited by Dan Tucker. It was mixed by Ari Mejia. You can support the work we do on Reset by liking and subscribing to our podcast. We drop new episodes every weekday with a special one on Saturday. You can also sign up for our newsletter. Head to wbez.org/resetnews. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.